Thank you very much. President Faust, thank you for your very generous introduction. Overly generous, but I'm grateful for it. And to Bill Clark, the chairman of the task force, whose findings are reported and adopted today, my congratulations to you and to all of the members of the task force, to the members of the faculty who are here, to the elected officials who are here, and to all of the distinguished guests. I congratulate Harvard on this achievement. I'm humbled by the kind words and the tremendous attention that has been paid to this task force report. But I must say I was reminded when you, I hadn't thought that my 40th was coming up this spring, but I guess it is. Not too long ago, I was with one of my partners in a restaurant. This is a true story, and we're sitting at the table, and a woman came walking by in front of the table, just staring at me as she walked past, and I didn't think anything about that, but a few moments later, out of the corner of my eye, I saw her coming from the opposite direction, and she just stared at me as she walked past the front of the table. So I looked up, and I said, "Hello, how are you?" And she said, "You know, if you dyed your hair black, you would look just like Al Gore." I said, "Thank you." She said, "You sound like him, too." So this was another such moment. But it was 41 years ago that I had the great good fortune as a student to walk into the class of Roger Revelle. And though I was not a science major, I was looking forward to that course, but I had no idea the impact that it would have on me. And I'm so grateful to Professor Revelle and his family. I'm still in touch with his family, by the way. His widow, Ellen Revelle, lives in San Diego near the Scripps Institute, approaching 100 years old, and really an amazing person. And I'm real proud to be a part of the greater university family as an alumnus, because what you're doing here is extremely significant. It reflects the very hard work of many, many people, and it reflects your leadership, President Faust, and I congratulate you for shepherding this initiative through and bringing all parts of the university together. Every faculty represented here. I won't recycle all the quotations about university politics that are well known, but everybody realizes it's quite a feat to get all of the different schools on board. But in many ways, what is most impressive is the size of the turnout here today, which speaks of a deep and broad commitment to addressing this issue throughout this university. Thank you all very much for being a part of this very impressive display. The role of the university in our civilization's effort to solve an existential crisis is worthy of some attention. How do we incorporate new knowledge into our understandings of who we are and what we must do? This year is the 400th anniversary of the invention in the Netherlands of the telescope. And only 1 year later, in 1609, Galileo perfected the instrument and saw the moons of Jupiter and the rings of Saturn and plotted the orbits of the planets around the sun and challenged the then common notion that the Earth was the center of the solar system and the universe itself. From the perspective of the Earth and the unaided human eye, it was perhaps understandable that we thought for so long that we were the center of the universe. But Galileo's new knowledge, presented first in salons to the Medicis and others, turned out to be, forgive the phrase, an inconvenient truth. By challenging the prevailing ideology of his age, he provoked persecution and imprisonment and withdrew his bold assertion. It is a similarly flawed and limited perspective that led us for so long to believe that the sky is so vast as to make it impervious to humankind's efforts to change it in any fundamental way. But only when we gained the new knowledge available from the perspective of space were we able to see that indeed the sky is a thin shell of a limited number of molecules surrounding our planet. 1/1000th the thickness of the Earth's diameter. And because the number of molecules is small enough, we are now in the process of radically changing the composition of the atmosphere. 160 years ago, a British scientist named John Tyndall discovered that CO2 molecules have the ability to intercept infrared radiation. And the normal, I use the word in reference to the period of time that is measured in the ice core records of our planet, dating back in the most recent measurement 800,000 years, but through other measures farther back. Through all that time, the concentration of CO2 molecules in the atmosphere rarely went above 280 parts per million and never above 300 parts per million. And that sounds like a small number, but the percentage of hemoglobin in the blood is also a small number, but if you change it radically, it does make a difference. And in the last century and a half, roughly speaking, we have seen a dramatic transformation of the relationship between humanity and this planet. Three factors have combined to transform our place on this earth: the population expansion that has led to a quadrupling of human numbers in less than a century, and after 10,000 generations led to a population of slightly more than 2 billion at the end of World War II, in my lifetime, it has increased from a little over 2 billion to 6.72 billion today. It will continue to increase until the demographers tell us with some increasing confidence it stabilizes somewhere above 9.1 to 9.2 billion some 50 years from now. And that is not a lever to grab hold of in an effort to solve the climate crisis, because it is stabilizing due to other factors. Four in particular: the education of girls, the empowerment of women, the availability of family planning, and higher child survival rates. Because when girls are educated and women are empowered and given the ability to control fertility and given the confidence that a few children will nevertheless ensure that the children live into adulthood, the preference for smaller families takes hold all over the world. And though this demographic transition has occurred first in the wealthier, industrial, developed countries, it is now taking hold more rapidly than anyone expected in the developing countries of the world as well. The death rates come down first, and then a little more than a generation later, the birth rates also fall. But even though it is stabilizing, it is nevertheless a very powerful explanatory force in helping us understand why we are now having such an impact on the earth. But the second factor is more important than the first. The scientific and technological revolution has vastly increased the power in the hands of the average human being on this earth to have an impact on the ecosphere. Some historians of science date the beginning of the scientific revolution to only a decade after Galileo's perfection of the telescope. In 1619, a young Frenchman in his 20s went to sleep on a riverbank in Germany and dreamed of a clockwork universe. And René Descartes awoke from that dream and began writing and speaking in ways that influenced the emergence of this powerful transformative force that is still accelerating throughout our world. The combination of this rapid expansion of our numbers and the dramatic expansion of the power we wield has been combined with the third and most subtle yet most decisive factor, our relatively recent adoption of an unnaturally short-term horizon for making decisions of great importance. We see it in the business world with the fascination with quarterly earnings reports. We see it in the political world with too much attention paid to overnight public opinion polls. We see it in the media with the sweeps weeks and ratings, and we see it throughout modern civilization. And it has led to a willful refusal to take into account the long-term consequences of short-term decisions. These three factors combined have caused the extraction of so much carbon from the Earth itself in such a short period of time as to change the composition in the atmosphere, as I've said. There is a well-known beginning sentence in English literature. They were the best of times, they were the worst of times. If we were to write a tale of two planets, it might be about Earth and Venus, described in a European science report last year as twins divided at the birth of the solar system. Earth and Venus are almost identical in size. No more than 400 kilometers separate the circumference of one from the circumference of the other. Earth and Venus have the identical quantity of carbon. But the carbon molecules that have throughout the eons been pulled out of the atmosphere of the Earth by the miracle of life and the unique geological processes on our planet have been left in the atmosphere of Venus because of the absence of those processes there. As a direct consequence, the average annual temperature on Earth is 59 degrees worldwide, and on Venus, 877 degrees. Above the melting point of lead, and it rains sulfuric acid. And no matter your disappointment with this morning's weather report, it wasn't that bad. This contrast is directly relevant to our current global strategy of pulling as much carbon out of the Earth as possible and burning it incredibly inefficiently in ways that have, in just a little more than a century, driven the concentration of CO2 from 300 parts per million to 387 parts per million on the way to who knows where. But the best projections now have it going to 500, 600 or more unless we change. This is, therefore, a unique moment in which we have to do something unprecedented, and that is make a decision as a species, a decision in favor of the survival of our human civilization. If we do not, the consequences would be clear. I believe we will. But if we are to accomplish that goal, we must find ways to make better use of the knowledge produced in universities by researchers and scientists who are pursuing the best available evidence and testing it with the rule of reason and then supplying their best and most reasoned conclusions as a basis for decision making. Not long after the telescope and the beginning of the scientific revolution, this university was founded, of course, in 1636. And from that time until this, Harvard has been a symbol of the devotion to the rule of reason that has been so important in the story of America. Our nation came out of the Enlightenment, and the emergence of the printing press and the public sphere that was accessible to those who could read and write led to a new sovereign being installed in power. Instead of kings and queens and emperors, there was the appeal to the rule of reason. There have been many changes, especially in the century just past, that have weakened the importance of reason and facts and knowledge in our public decision-making processes. For example, the day before the United States Senate voted to invade Iraq, the public opinion poll showed that more than three quarters of the American people were utterly convinced that Saddam Hussein was the person principally responsible for crashing the planes into the World Trade Center towers and the other targets. And my purpose is not to revisit that mistake, but rather to ask the question, how could such an important decision be based on such a false belief? It's not as if false beliefs have not inspired wrong decisions throughout our history, but it does seem to be more commonplace today. When scientific findings are actively censored because they are inconvenient and replaced with industry finance substitute language that turns out to be friendlier to the objectives of those who have written the language, it inspires many of us to ask, why is there not more outrage when the rule of reason is so cavalierly dismissed? I don't know about you. I'm not going to speak about our president and vice president because I've recently begun to fear that I'm losing my objectivity. But I will say that I've reached the point that when a new outrage comes along, I have to download some existing outrage to make room for the new outrage. Maybe there's something we can figure out to do about that in the next couple of weeks. That was pretty tame. Pretty tame. Now we are in the midst of an economic crisis triggered by the subprime mortgage fiasco. When my wife Tipper and I first married and were expecting our first child, we went to the bank and signed a mortgage. We made a down payment and provided proof or evidence that we were capable of making the regular payments on the mortgage. I thought it still worked that way, but no. The new innovation, dispensing with the requirement of either a down payment or any credible proof that regular payments could be continued, was nevertheless said to be relatively devoid of risk because all such loans were lumped together and securitized and sold into the global financial marketplace. The assumption that the risk had been magically removed was an assumption that suddenly collapsed, triggering fear in the financial markets, and the rest unfolded quickly. We've all heard the saying that the most powerful thing in the world is an idea whose time has come. Less well known is that the second most powerful thing may well be an assumption whose time is suddenly past. We now have, and this is the reason I told that story, one of two reasons, we now have a few trillion dollars of subprime carbon assets whose value is based on another assumption that is in the process of collapsing, namely that it is perfectly all right to put 70 million tons of global warming pollution into that thin shell of atmosphere every 24 hours. It's not okay. The fact that CO2 is invisible, tasteless, odorless, and not given any price tag does not take away the risk, does not change the reality. For years now, since Tyndall's discovery and since Professor Roger Revelle hired Charles David Keeling and they began the historic set of measurements 50 years ago that have painstakingly, with great precision, documented the steady rise in the concentration of CO2 and other greenhouse gases in our atmosphere. Since that time, science has been speaking to society with increasing clarity and increasing urgency that we have to act. But that knowledge has not yet penetrated to the councils where the decisions are made. Just as that false belief on the eve of the Iraq invasion led to what I believe was a terrible mistake, the false view that the sky is so vast that we cannot affect it and that the greenhouse effect beyond the natural consequence magnified by all this man-made pollution is not a dire threat, that has led to a much more serious mistake, a failure of nerve, a failure of moral leadership, a willingness to ignore this grave threat to the future of our civilization. The economic crisis is closely connected to the climate crisis. The $700 billion price tag for the rescue plan or bailout plan, depending on how you feel about it, is a number that we've heard before. It is the cost of the Iraq war so far, but more importantly, it is $700 billion is the annual cost to bail out the U.S. economy by sending that much money to foreign nations in return for foreign oil every single year. And what you have heard described as the greatest transfer of wealth in the history of the human race is directly connected to our absurd overdependence on carbon-based fuels. One of the many reasons for the miscalculation in going to Iraq was, in my view, the influence of a particular way of thinking about the necessity for the United States to be able to militarily guarantee continued access to the largest single source of proven oil reserves in the world. So the national security results of that decision, the economic crisis, the financial crisis, the debt crisis, and the climate crisis all have the same thread running through them: overdependence on carbon-based fuels. When you pull that thread, all of these crises begin to unravel and you hold in your hand the solution. We need to substitute renewable energy for carbon-based energy. It's just that simple. We need to put a price on carbon, we need a global treaty, and we need American leadership. I mentioned the role of the university and the challenge of using knowledge wisely. At the end of World War II, a group of German philosophers, later known as the Frankfurt School, gathered to probe deeply into the deeper meanings of the unfathomable evil that had overtaken Germany and the Axis powers. And one of the founders of that school, Theodor Adorno, conducted a kind of spiritual autopsy of the Third Reich and identified what he felt was the first inflection on the slope down into the evil that ensued. And he wrote a sentence that has significance for me. He said, "All questions of fact became questions of power." What we are witnessing in the United States is not in any way what he described. And that is not my point. But here is my point. Questions of fact should be questions to be explored, subjected to the rule of reason, debated, tested against other facts. Questions of fact should be questions of fact. And when they are discovered and debated and presented in the university, they should not be waylaid on their pathway into the public forum and twisted, censored, and replaced on the basis of power, whether economic, political, financial, or whatever. They should remain questions of fact. Too many of our decisions in this country are now made on the basis of information supplied not from universities, not from processes governed by the rule of reason, but instead by self-interested institutions, corporations, groups that want to make questions of fact questions of power. Our challenge is to find the truth of the climate crisis and use it as a basis for the development of a new consciousness of who we are. A half century ago, Martin Luther King Jr. said that injustice anywhere threatens justice everywhere. In our day, increasing CO2 emissions anywhere threaten the future of human civilization everywhere. We are one people living on one planet. We have a very few short years within which to make a dramatic change in the way we organize and conduct global civilization. It is almost absurd to imagine that we, the human race, could make a decision as a species. But that is, in fact, the challenge before us right now. We are capable of rising to this challenge. But the knowledge now available must be used as a basis for shifting our perspective on ourselves, just as Galileo shifted our perspective on the Earth's place in the universe, just as the Apollo mission shifted our perspective about the uniqueness of the Earth itself and our place on it. There is an African proverb that says, "If you want to go quickly, go alone. If you want to go far, go together." We have to go far, quickly. For the last day and a half, courtesy of Graham Allison and his colleagues at the Kennedy School, I've joined with a large group of researchers and policymakers, engineers and scientists to discuss a challenge And I believe the United States should undertake this challenge to make a commitment that within 10 years, we will get 100% of our electricity from renewable and carbon-free sources here in the United States of America. One of the solutions to the climate crisis involves making a generational commitment to a one-off massive investment to transform our energy infrastructure from one that depends on these dirty, dangerous, expensive fuels that are based on carbon and rising in price to a new energy infrastructure that is not free but is based on fuels that are free forever, the sun and the wind and the natural heat of the earth. We can make that transformation. We can see the United States of America reclaim its rightful role as a moral leader of this world. We can do it sooner than people think it is possible. We can, with American leadership, galvanize a global commitment to solve the climate crisis. We must do it with this generation. We have everything we need, with the possible exception of political will, but political will is a renewable resource. Thank you very much.